We come on to the ballad of Peckham Rye by Muriel Spark, which is a short, entertaining, I hope you found entertaining text, which I think works very well for us for all kinds of reasons in terms of the way in which it engages with the post-war scene, particularly the 1950s. It's published in 1960, but is distinctively set in the 1950s. And which has, and it's a very idiosyncratic book. It's an early novel by Spark, but it has a lot of her characteristic stylistic traits. So it's, and it also connects in interesting ways, I think, to the novel we've looked at before, Under the Volcano, and the novel we'll look at next, Tremor of Intent. And I'll try and tease out some of those in the lecture. I'm going to say a little bit about Spark as a novelist to start with, something about her career and something about the kind of writer that she developed into. Say something also about the context of the times in terms of the urban milieu that we're talking about here and the kinds of concerns that people had in the social realm, cultural realm at the time. And then move on to say a little bit more about the style and technique of this particular work and focusing perhaps on its comic elements particularly. So we'll start by saying a little bit about Muriel Spark herself. That picture is taken round about the time that she's writing this novel. So that's what she looked like then. She was born in 1918 and had a long life, as you can see, dying relatively recently in 2006. And is born in Edinburgh, but of a sort of slightly unusual background. Her father was an engineer, Jewish, of Jewish extraction. Her mother was English. Father was Scottish, mother was English, but had a kind of rather exotic ancestry, which becomes kind of disputed later on as part of the ongoing feud that she has with her son. She is brought up in Edinburgh. She attends a girls' school, which is later going to be the model for the Marcia Blaine School in her most famous novel, The Crime of Miss Jean Brodie, and doesn't go to university because at the age of 19 she marries a man called Spark, hence her name, and leaves for Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. Rhodesia, then still very much part of the empire, and he's going to be a teacher and she's going to be his wife. And Mr. Spark, Sidney Spark, turns out to be a rather unpleasant man. He's a manic depressive who gets increasingly violent. And so the marriage is an unhappy one. Doesn't last very long. But he does produce a son called Robin, who is going to be, and that's going to be problematic later on. So she is unhappy in this marriage and leaves him, gets divorced, and eventually returns to Britain in 1944, before the end of the war. And she begins to do some war work, which is largely black propaganda. So she's involved in writing fiction, basically, to broadcast to the enemy and to demoralise them at the end of the war. So it's interesting, actually, that her first kind of professional work as a writer is this business of taking factual things and sort of turning them into fiction. That's what she does for a couple of years until the end of the war. So she's back in Britain, in those post-war years that we looked at in the first week, and she's divorced, and she has this son who she actually parks with her, with his grandparents, so she doesn't have much to do with the son, and that, I'd say that's going to be problematic later on. So she, to all intents and purposes, then she's a single woman. In London, she lives in London, in places which are not dissimilar. She doesn't live in Peckham, actually, but she did live in Camberwell, and she lives in sort of places which are not dissimilar to the kind of environment that she describes in the Ballad of Peckham Rye. She then has a career as a sort of editor. She's the Poetry Review was an influential, still is an influential magazine published by the Poetry Society, and she manages to become, I think, the first female editor of the Poetry Review at the end of the 40s. And she considers herself to be a poet, and she's also publishing her own poetry at the time. She's interested in new directions in poetry, which goes against the grain of the Poetry Society. So she's actually dismissed from the editorship of the Poetry Review because she was quite keen on modernist poetry, and her bosses at the Poetry Society were not. So it's interesting, actually, if you look at the edition after her last edition of the Poetry Review, there's a kind of long explanation as to why they've dismissed her. But as far as one can work out, the reason was that they just didn't like her views very much at all, so they got rid. She's also at this time writing some short literary critical works, sort of introductory works to various classic writers, people like John Masefield, Mary Shelley. And she writes these with a man called Derek Stanford, who is later to go on to write a rather critical biography of her, and she falls out with him. 1954 is a key year, I think, in her development as a writer, because it's at that point that she has a breakdown, a nervous breakdown, probably as a result of taking Dexedrine, which is a kind of stimulant, but it gave her hallucinations, and she was in quite a bad way. So she had this breakdown, and having been, she's always been interested in kind of religious belief, and having been baptized into the Anglican Church, she then converts to Catholicism in 1954, and begins to write prose fiction, which he hadn't written before, and starts writing novels, the first of which is published in 1957, The Comforters, but written probably from about 1955 onwards. And The Comforters is a very interesting first work. That dust jacket that you can see there is slightly odd, isn't it? It does that thing where it refers to itself, you know. So here's a book called The Comforters, which shows on the front of its cover a book called The Comforters, which shows on its cover a book called The Comforters, and so on. And the story is clearly semi-autobiographical, I think, because it's based on, its central character is a novelist. So it has that kind of postmodern self-reflexive thing. You know, this is writing about writing, so it's got a novelist, as a female novelist, as a central character. And like Muriel Spark herself, this female novelist hears voices and has hallucinations. And these emanate, apparently, from something called the typing ghost. So it's kind of associated with the typewriter and associated with the act of writing. And that introduces, obviously, the element of the supernatural, which is one of the features of Spark's work. That, you know, in quite a few of her novels, there is this element of the supernatural, and of course we get that in Ballad of Peckham Rye as well. It's a feature, it's a motif of her writing that goes right way through to the end of her career. So it's very playful, it's very, very self-reflexive, and there are bits, you know, there's an indication towards the end of that novel that, you know, the novel that you have been reading is actually a construct of the novelist whose story we've been reading about. It's a kind of circular progression. So she's already establishing herself, some of the distinctive features of her style at that point. Later on, as we said at the start, you know, she has a long career, and she's still writing the year before she dies. In fact, she's publishing novels the year before she dies, in her 80s. So 22 novels in a 50-year writing career is not a bad strike rate. And of course, what she's best known for is the novel The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which was made into a very successful film starring Maggie Smith, Downton Abbey fame. But for those of you who didn't come across Maggie Smith, she's been actually very famous since the 1960s. The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie is really important in Spark's career for several reasons. First of all, it gets her name noticed. You know, the fact that it's made into this blockbusting film that I think won some Oscars, but if it didn't, it was certainly very well received and very popular. It means that her, you know, there's obviously interest in her as a writer, and by this stage she's written, I think, 5 or 6 novels by that stage. One of the distinctive features you'll have noticed about Ballad of Peckham Rye is its brevity. It's a short novel, and that tends to be the sort of length that her novels are. So she does churn them out quite quickly at that stage in her career. This becomes a very, very popular novel and film. Obviously, the film tie-in is important. And what it means in terms of her career is that she actually becomes very comfortably well off. So she's able to become much more independent than she was. When we think about The Comforters, the previous novel that I mentioned just now, that's published really on the encouragement of Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene. Obviously, both Catholic, you know, prominent Catholic novelists themselves, and very famous at the time. And in fact, apparently Greene supported Muriel Spark financially at the same time as well. She was paying her rent at the time. And a friend sent the manuscript of The Comforters to Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene, both of whom thought it was publishable. And I think Waugh wrote a sort of blurb for it. And obviously that was helpful in publishing it, because you've got a major name endorsing it. So that launches her, and then, as I say, her career really takes off with Miss Jean Brodie. And so then, perhaps as a result of that, she's financially independent, and so she leaves Britain, where she's never really got into the sort of literary world. She's never got on with that sort of idea of a coterie of literary people. And she goes off to live in Rome, first of all, and then she moves off into Tuscany, I think. And that's where she stays for the rest of her life. And, you know, in a sort of link to our next novel, which is Tremor of Intent, then Burgess does a very similar thing. You know, having had a successful novel, he disappears to Europe and never really comes back. So, there is a kind of connection between Spark and Burgess, which we might explore a bit. So that's briefly what her career was like. She, having had this unsuccessful marriage in the 1940s, she met a woman who became her extremely close companion, with whom she lived for the rest of her life in Italy, and who is her literary executor. And that's, you know, that's how her life panned out. So she spent the rest of her life in Italy producing these, you know, these very frequent novels, very prolific writer. So that's briefly Muriel Spark. We come now to think about The Ballad of Peckham Rye as a novel in its own right. As I say, because it's published in 1960, obviously technically in the 60s, but it's very much a novel of the 1950s. I suppose the first most obvious point of interest is the title. We've got a piece of prose fiction here, but its title is The Ballad of Peckham Rye. And so the ballad suggests something else, doesn't it? And I want to say something about that later on, but I mean, perhaps just to, you know, just to establish, when we say ballad, you know, we're not talking about a big romantic song that somebody sings on The Voice. We're talking about a tale of usually murder, magic, and the supernatural from the folk tradition and recorded in the oral tradition and eventually written down by people like Child collected in collections like the Border Ballads. Walter Scott, for example, collected them in his Tales of Minstrelsy. These were the border ballads of the Scottish-English borderlands. So when she says ballad, that's the kind of thing she's talking about. We mentioned before that she often has this kind of element of the supernatural in her writing, and of course, Dougal Douglas, or is it Douglas Dougal, in The Ballad of Peckham Rye, is a representative of that, you know, and the idea of the power that he has, is that exercised supernaturally, or is it just kind of charisma, force of personality? There's certainly a debate about that. There's certainly some ambiguity and ambivalence about that in the way in which he's presented in the novel. So that's something to focus on when we talk about it. And the other thing, I think, is to say this is a novel very much set in a particular locale. It's set in Peckham, a working-class district of London. And perhaps significantly, for our purposes, although it's a, you know, very kind of prosaic and ordinary place, Peckham Rye, which is the sort of parkland in the middle of the borough, Peckham Rye was where William Blake, famously had a vision of an angel. So I think we can probably expect, you know, somebody like Spark with her literary background, you know, maybe having that at the back of her mind in choosing that location. So it's a place which combines, you know, very kind of ordinary, post-war, rather dull, sort of place, nothing particularly special about it, with this little element of something strange, something supernatural, something not perhaps explicable. So there's Peckham High Street in 1955, actually, that picture was taken. So this is exactly the sort of scene that would have confronted Dougal and Dixie and the other characters in the novel. It's a working class district. It's largely 19th century housing, and there's some element of social deprivation because it begins to have quite a big immigrant population after the Windrush, you know, after the war, that wave of immigration then. So it becomes a place of concern, and actually, what happens? This sort of street view that you get here. What happens in the 60s is that There's a huge regeneration program, so most of the old houses are swept away, and there's a lot of high-rise flats in brutalist concrete constructed, and probably not much of an improvement really in people's living standards as a result. But the world of Peckham that's in the novel is the world that you see in that photograph there. This is a world of it's not prosperous, but it's not completely deprived either. It's struggling with the post-war situation, as we mentioned a couple of times previously. And it's a place that has no particular distinctive features, really. It's a suburb of London, working class. A lot of the people will work locally or travel into London to work. So that's the kind of physical setting. I want to say something about balladry now. Muir Spark stresses in interviews and on other occasions, there's an autobiography, a rather strange autobiography called Curriculum Vitae. She stresses her Scottish background. She says, although she doesn't identify as, you know, a Scottish novelist, that nonetheless her Scottishness is part of her, and it's something which is part of her makeup and has contributed to what she becomes. And if we think about that, then part of the distinctive Scottish tradition in terms of literature are those border ballads, and, you know, that tradition of the sort of common people telling their stories about life and death in ballad form. But more interestingly, perhaps, she herself was interested in the idea of the ballad. And she wrote something called The Ballad of Fanfarlo. And this is a long poem written in ballad meter, you know, it's sort of loose form, rhyming couplets or quatrains, which most ballads are written in. So she's very deliberately evoking that ballad tradition when she writes The Ballad of Fanfarlo. And Fanfarlo is based on a short story by Baudelaire, who you recall we mentioned when we were talking about Malcolm Lowry and Under the Volcano. So it all links up, amazingly. Baudelaire, of course, is famous as a poet, Les Fleurs du Mal, and other poems, but he did actually write one short prose piece, this novella, which is called Fanfarlo. And this novella is about a poet, a kind of visionary, a kind of, I suppose, sort of Blakean sort of poet, really, a dreamer called Cramer. And he has, he develops this overwhelming love and desire for a dancer called Fanfarlo. And the Baudelaire story tells of this kind of doomed love and his rediscovery of Fanfarlo years later on, when she's put on a lot of weight and you know isn't the vision that he remembers. In her version, in the Ballad of Fanfarlo that Spark wrote, she does something rather odd. She takes this story and she transposes it to contemporary London. So she's talking about the 1950s London. So this is the kind of relevance to the Ballad of Peckham Rye. And Cramer, the poet, has these various encounters with different people. He also has encounters with inanimate objects. He has encounters with things like traffic lights and chairs as well. So there's a rather kind of surreal element to this ballad that Spark wrote. And at the end of all this, he has an encounter with death. You know, capital D, death, death figured as a person. That takes you all the way back to the ballads, because there are quite a few ballads which actually feature death as a character. And you might go back even to things like The Pardoner's Tale by Chaucer, where death is a character. And of course, you might also remember that medieval Renaissance tradition of the graphic representation of death, the dance of death, where you get these pictures of people who are apparently well off and prosperous and enjoying their lives, but there's these skeletal figures of death dancing around them. It's a reminder of death. It's a memento mori. Title of Muriel Spark's third novel, Memento Mori. So there's some quite interesting connections to make there, I think. Spark writes in ballad form, as I say, but she also writes with these sort of curious modernist touches. So, for example, there's a line that she uses that goes like this. She's talking about the moon. The new moon, like a pair of surgical forceps, with the old moon in its jaws. You're not going to get references to surgical forceps in the old ballads, but you are going to get references to the old and the new moon. And in fact, if you know your ballads, then you'll recognise the idea of the old moon with the new moon in its arms, is a line from the old ballad of Sir Patrick Spence, my ancestor. But the surgical forceps, that's obviously a very kind of modern touch. And it might remind you of the opening of Giafra Prufrock by Eliot. If you remember the opening line of that, or the opening lines of that, start with, "Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky." So that sounds all very kind of natural. And then the second line, "like a patient etherized on a table." Which is not very natural at all, and has this kind of rather cold, scientific, and rather disturbing air about it. So she's having that kind of effect, I think, in her version of the ballad. The other thing I think which is interesting and connects with the novel, in terms of how she saw the ballad, is in one of those early literary critical books, one about John Masefield. And John Masefield, a very kind of traditional poet who also had some connection with those, with that oral tradition. She says about the border ballads, about this collection of ballads that come from the Scottish-English border. She said, "Those ballads are concerned with the lyrical winding in and out of a situation. For all their repetitiveness and length, they are models of narrative economy." Now, models of narrative economy, in other words, they tell the story in an economical way, even though they're built on this idea of repetition. And of course, this is the kind of thing that you get in the Ballad of Peckham Rye. It's a very short text. It tells a short story. It's almost rather a novella rather than a novel, isn't it, because of its length. And it does have that element of repetition. If you look at the first chapter, you look at the last chapter, you're being told the same information in more or less the same way. So she obviously has sort of taken that on board, really. The other thing that we might get from Spark's Scottish background is her interest in the idea of the double. Now, if you think about her central character here, Dougal Douglas, then he is a kind of a double, isn't he? And there is this long tradition of the double in particularly Scottish literature that goes back probably to James Hogg's gothic novel of the 1820s, Justified Sinner. The representation in that novel, you've got two brothers who don't know each other because they're sort of half brothers, and one of them is stalking the other, and eventually kills the other. But the killing is has this supernatural element, and people don't recognize who the killer is, and the killer seems to be a double of the person that he's killed. So this idea of evil in the form of a sort of doppelganger character is something which is also there in the background when Spark is coming to write, I think. It's part of her Scottish heritage, if you like. So if we move on now to say something in more detail about Peckham Rye. So Dougal Douglas, to start with, obviously our central character. Well, his name is a kind of doubling in itself, isn't it? The two elements, you know, he's Doug, it's the same syllable. And of course, it's capable of being reversed because he's Dougal Douglas in one sphere that he works in and he's Douglas Dougal in the other one. So his name in itself is a kind of doubling and recalls that idea of the double. He's also Scottish, of course, and his Scottishness is emphasised at various points. You know, there are bits where he uses some Scottish dialect. You know, when Mr. Druce is about to cry, he says, "Oh, it's good to have a wee greet." In other words, you know, have a cry, but it's a Scottish dialect word. You'll recall that he can do the Highland fling, and he does various other stereotypical Scottish things. But he's obviously been taken out of his Scottish milieu. He's not in Edinburgh anymore, he's in London. So he is what might be described, and this is Willie Maley, the critic, uses this term, the depicted Scot. It's a kind of jokey term. So he's no longer the picked, you know, as the sort of ancient Scottish warriors, you know, the ones that put blue woad on themselves and so on, the picts. He's not that. He's taken out of that milieu, but he still has some of the characteristics of Scottishness. He's also a shapeshifter, and Gil Martin, who's the... Who's the evil character in Hogg's Confessions of a Justified Sinner, also has that shape-shifting characteristic. And again, this is a kind of supernatural element which Spark very casually sort of drops in, you know, that you almost don't notice. So when we first come across Dougal, having his interview with Mr. Druce, this is on page 16, Mr. Druce says he wants an arts man, and Mr. Druce paced the floor while Dougal sat like a monkey puzzle tree, only moving his eyes to follow Mr. Bruce. "You'll find the world of industry a tough one, Mr. Bruce." People want to call him Bruce. Druce said. Dougal changed his shape and became a professor. He leant one elbow over the back of his chair and reflected kindly upon Mr. Druce. So that's a curious sentence to use, isn't it? He changed his shape and became a professor. We get something from Mr. Druce, and then Dougal leant forward and became a television interviewer. So this kind of idea that he's a shapeshifter is built into his character. So there's that kind of supernatural element to him. And there's a few other places, I think, where you see that happening quite explicitly. So, for example, at the dance that he's at, this is on page 60, he does this kind of tour de force where he keeps becoming different people or different types. Dougal bowed to the black girls. Next, Dougal sat on his haunches and banged a message out on a tom-tom. He sprang up and with the lid on his head was a Chinese coolie eating melancholy rice. He was an ardent cyclist, crouched over handlebars and pedalling uphill with the lid between his knees. He was an old woman with an umbrella. He stood on the upturned edges of the lid and speared fish from his rocking canoe. He was the man at the wheel of a racing car. He did many things with the lid before he finally propped the dustbin lid up on his high shoulder. Remember, he's got that kind of odd odd sort of Richard III thing going on there. Propped the dustin lid off on his high shoulder, beating this cymbal rhythmically with his hand, while with the other hand he limply conducted an invisible band, being, with long blank face, the band leader. So, you know, it's kind of extraordinary display that he puts on, which is, on the one hand, you could say it's a kind of, he's just showing off, you know, he's just clever at that sort of thing. On the other, maybe rather disturbing, maybe rather strange that he can manipulate his expression, he can manipulate his attitude so readily. And a couple of other things. Again, jokey, but, you know, significant, I think. This is on page 87, where he's talking about his inability to cross a river. You know, it's a strange exchange that he has with Mr. Drews. "I need your advice," Mr. Drews said. "There's a place in Soho." "I don't like crossing the river," Dougal said. "Not without my broomstick." Not without my broomstick. Well, there's a kind of tradition that you may have come across where witches are, you know, that's what, it's one way of kind of working out if it really is a witch. You know, can they cross running water by going over a bridge? No. Unless they have their broomstick where they can fly over it. So he jokingly connects himself with that kind of supernatural tradition there. And then, you know, perhaps even more disturbingly, you know, he associates himself with cemeteries, doesn't he? And I think that page reference is wrong, actually. That's largely because there aren't 173 pages in the book. That's weird, isn't that? Spooky, it's supernatural, something has happened there. It's changed, you know, so I can't tell you exactly where that goes. But this is a bit where he's in the cemetery with Merle, and he's heard about the death of her, we think, her brother. And he says, "Have you ever seen a corpse?" She says, "No." And then he becomes a corpse. He rolls his eyes back and he bares his teeth. He becomes a corpse. So it's actually, you know, some fairly disturbing elements to his character, which do link him with this kind of supernatural idea, I think. So a bit more about him in terms of not just his character, but in terms of what he does within the plot. He disrupts the realism of the plot. You know, if you think about the other elements of the plot, what you've got are, you know, there's some melodrama in there, and of course, you know, going back to the idea of the ballad, we do have a sort of classic ballad event where the jealous lover, Mr. Drews, kills the object of his love. In this case, kills her with the corkscrew, if you remember. So there is a kind of realistic plot which is about mundane things. It's about Dixie and her marriage, and, you know, the various jealousies that go on there. It's about Leslie the boy's sort of petty thievery and dishonesty and so on. So you've got that, but he comes in as this kind of force of nature from outside and disrupts the lives of all these people. He's also a source of sexual confusion because he seems to have this kind of sexual charisma, even though he's rather odd in terms of his looks. You know, he's got his one shoulder higher than the other. He's got these two strange bumps on his head. And also seems to equally entrance male and female. You know, he has this moment where he's with Mr. Drews, which has kind of homoerotic overtones. He also introduces the idea within the story of playing with the idea of fiction and reality. So if you recall, he's supposed to be writing this, or ghostwriting, and again, that's another kind of playful idea, isn't it? You know, that this is going to be the autobiography of this actress, but in fact, he's writing it. So you know, it's not the autobiography, it's somebody else that's writing it. But going beyond that, he wants to introduce elements that he's discovered from his research, in inverted commas, which is his the work that he's called upon to do for the company. And at the end of the novel, we're told that what he does with all this information, or this experience that he's had, and again, it's a typical Spark touch, I think. She very often, when you read a novel, she very often tells you the outcome. You know, normally with standard traditional novels, we find out about the characters in the moment that they're operating, don't we? What Spark quite often does is tell you the life of that person later on. You know, so we might leave a character in a certain position, but then Spark will tell us, well, yeah, she went on to marry somebody, and then she emigrated, and then this happened and that happened. And yeah, that's not part of the story, but you get this whole kind of filling in of detail. And something similar happens at the end of this novel, where we get detail of Dougal's subsequent life. We get the repetition, very ballad-like, of the "Wilt thou have this woman to be thy wedded wife?" No, to be quite frank, I won't, says Humphrey. And we've had, you know, the kind of interpretation of that, and again, that's very sort of ballad-like. You know, the ballads change because it's oral tradition. Bits get added, bits get taken away, emphasis changes, and so on. And that's what's happened with the story of Dixie and Humphrey. But Dougal doesn't find anything out about it. He returned from Africa and became a novice in a Franciscan monastery before he was asked to leave. You know, we're not told why that might be, but we can guess. The prior had endured a nervous breakdown, and several of the monks had broken their vows of obedience. Dougal pleaded his powers as an exorcist in vain. Therefore, for economy's sake, he gathered together the scrap ends of his profligate experience and turned them into a lot of cockeyed books and went far in the world. He never married. So there's a little hint there, even, that, you know, perhaps what we've been experiencing is Dougal's take on this experience. If he's turning his experience into a lot of cockeyed books, well, at that stage, we are virtually on the last page of what you might call a cockeyed book. So again, is that kind of postmodern self-reflexiveness about the novel? A couple of other things then to say, just picking up on that idea of how the novel's structured and styled. Nothing like actually, Under the Volcano, but except it does share one similarity, which is that our first chapter is chronologically late in terms of the narrative. And then we work backwards, don't we, and find out how we got to that point. And then the capping final chapter kind of moves us on a bit and corrects the versions of the narrative mentioned in chapter one. You know, we find out what really happened after the breakdown at the altar between Dixie and Humphrey. And I think the other thing that's worth pointing out with Spark is that part of the economical narrative, part of the reason why these novels are so short, is that she doesn't expend any energy on what you might think of as linkage, what you might think of as, you know, tying things together. We move from one scene to another, actually in quite cinematic style. It's the idea of the cut. You know, we get something and we cut to another scene and so on. I think that's a particularly distinctive element of Spark's style. And just returning to that idea of the supernatural, elements of the supernatural are presented as unremarkable, and I think, you know, that idea of sort of casually dropping things in is present in various places. So in the park, for example, this is at the bottom of page 30, she let him take her, sorry, not the park, the cemetery. She let him take her through the cemetery eventually, Dougal posed like an angel on a grave, which had only an insignificant headstone. He posed like an angel devil, with his humped shoulder and gleaming smile, and his fingers of each hand widespread against the sky. She looked startled, then she laughed. So she has that kind of dual response. She's scared, and then she's amused. Angel devil. You know, he seems to combine these characteristics within himself. He also relates that he's had a dream of himself as the devil, which is which is rather strange. And this is where he's talking to Humphrey. He says, "Feel these little bumps up here," and these are the things that he was born with. Apparently, "I had it done by a plastic surgeon," Dougal said, which is not what he said before. He did an operation and took away the two horns. "You're supposed to be the devil then," Humphrey says a bit later. "Oh no, I'm only supposed to be one of the wicked spirits that wander through the world for the ruin of souls." Wander through the world for the ruin of souls. So, you know, if he is that, then he is that kind of Mephistophelian character that we encountered partly in Under the Volcano. And even right at the end, you know, where he's battling to get away from Peckham, and he goes under the old nunnery where these bones are buried. He uses those as weapons, and he tries to suggest to Trevor that, you know, they've got these kind of supernatural powers, and he needs to back away from them. So there's lots of little suggestions of the supernatural in there, but they're never quite carried through. So you don't get the idea that you're reading a novel where supernatural events take place. Everything that we read could be explained rationally, but nonetheless, there's this kind of unease about Dougal's role, I think. So, what have we got here? We've got a comic novel, essentially, which deals with big issues. It's dealing with people's relationships, it's dealing with life and death, it's dealing with morality, with mortality as well, but it's doing it in comic form. It has passages, it's mainly written in this kind of realist way, but it has passages which are more like from a modernist perspective. It has that blurring of facts and fiction, both in terms of, you know, presenting something where you have this kind of sense of a realistic location, but which has some surreal elements added to it. And ultimately, I think you have to decide how far you're going to go along with that. And if you read the introduction to the Penguin edition by William Boyd, he actually suggests that the supernatural idea is perhaps a bit overplayed. My view would be, well, yeah, that might be the case. But on the other hand, then, why have a character like Dougal in the novel who can apparently do these sort of semi-supernatural things, or at least things that can be interpreted that way? What Boyd says is that it's so situated in the grime and petit bourgeois mundanity of post-war London that you can't really think of it in those sorts of terms. And of course, that is, I think, ultimately the way that you've got to decide how you're going to respond to it. There is that sense of it being very firmly placed in a particular location, and, you know, there's a lot of detail, and there's a lot of detail about people's ordinary lives, their working lives, the way that they entertain themselves after work, and so on and so forth, that does place it very firmly in that world. On the other hand, there are these other elements, you know, and you have to decide how much you're going to weigh those in your evaluation of them. So I think it's, you know, it's a fascinating little book. It is a little book. It says a lot about the world of post-war Britain, and it has a lot to recommend it, I think, in terms of interest in stylistic features and some of the themes that it raises. So it's well worth its inclusion, I think, on our course. So we'll carry on with this discussion in class. Thank you.